Hi everyone, welcome to ADHD Brief. I'm Kaylee Smith, a registered psychotherapist in Ontario and your host. This isn't your typical therapy podcast. Here, I ditch the clipboard and sit down with friends, family, and people with lived experience to have informal, unfiltered conversations about ADHD, mental health, and what it's actually like to live with a neurodivergent brain. As a therapist, I love having these conversations, but this podcast isn't therapy and it isn't intended to provide personal clinical advice. It's real talk, personal stories, and don't worry, we still try to keep it funny. Whether you've been diagnosed, you're exploring your brain, or you're just ADHD curious, welcome. Brains don't always play by the rules. Let's talk about it. So, welcome to this week's episode of ADHD Brief. I have a very special guest here today, Emma Hoichi. So Emma is not only a trusted colleague, but she is also a very good friend of mine. We're so happy to have her today. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you so much, Kaylee, for having me on your podcast. And let me just say, you are so brave to do this. I am excited and a little anxious.
Okay, well, we'll try to make you less anxious. Thank you very much for the compliment. I appreciate it. So a little bit of background about Emma. Emma is an RP in Ontario, and she is also the clinic owner of Ask Psychotherapy Hub in Toronto. And for anyone listening, it is truly one of the most beautiful therapy spaces I have ever seen in my life. If you are in Toronto, you should check them out. But Emma's clinic is, you're welcome. Emma's clinic is a neurodivergent affirming clinic. And so this is kind of a great segue into what today's episode is going to be about, which is the crossover between neurodivergence and eating disorders. Mm-hmm. So we're going to start with Emma's background and her early work as a therapist, and then what led her to grow into the clinic she's in. So why don't we start with a little bit about your background and what kind of led you to working with eating disorders?
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Kaylee. So I myself struggled with an eating disorder, and that's what it was diagnosed as and what I identified as having throughout high school. And so when I was about 14 or 15, I learned about purging. Mm. And I think I always, you know, loved candy and sweets, but the culture in my household was one of, you know, maybe an almond mother. My mom was very, you know, big on low calorie, low fat, not having a bunch of junk food.
Yeah.
And, you know, the commentary around having chips in the house was that my dad would finish them all before my mom could have any. And so looking back, you know, binge eating was kind of normalized or joked about or not seen as an eating disorder.
Yeah.
Until I started to lose weight, and my mom very quickly caught on. And so that brought me to therapy when I was in high school.
Okay. So you're a teenager at this point. So you've got some interesting kind of messaging around food and relationships with food when you're a kid moving into your teenage years. And then that for you turned into an eating disorder, what you would classify as an eating disorder.
Yes, okay. For sure. By the DSM criteria, you know, I definitely didn't fit neatly into one bucket. I had bulimia with a bit of anorexia qualities, with a bit of, you know, binge, whether that was exercising to purge or vomiting to purge. And so that's what's a bit tough with eating disorders is, you know, we really try to fit it into a category.
Yeah.
But a lot of folks don't, you know, have all the criteria of one eating disorder, or they might kind of have symptoms that, you know, aren't in the DSM.
Strict. That's, I think that's such a good point to make, even when I'm saying what would be classified as an eating disorder, for you to specify not only that there's like different types of disordered eating, but yeah, that you can fall anywhere within those kind of like categories and not specifically fit a set of criteria, yeah, that we use for diagnosis. So that's a great point to make.
Yeah. And so my mom, being very intellectual and a researcher, you know, she was very on my eating disorder and how to fix it. Mm. And so she brought me to the family doctor and was very disappointed, almost, you know, kind of, it was my fault, that when I went in with the doctor, my family doctor didn't talk about it with me. Mm. And so I left that appointment thinking, oh, you know, this must not be actually a problem. This must be what most people are doing. Mm-hmm. And so my mom, you know, would read about how eating disorders have one of the highest mortality rates of any mental illness, mm-hmm, and kind of ring the alarm bells that I should go off to treatment. Mm. But my dad was very much of the mindset that I'll grow out of it and it's not a big deal. You know, he saw me still playing sports, mm-hmm, still doing well in school. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was kind of this push-pull at home. And that was the only place where my eating disorder was known. Mm. At high school and with my closest friends, you know, it was my biggest secret.
Right.
So, you know, with an eating disorder, there's lots of strategies to keep it in the dark. Mm. So whether that's like, you know, lying and saying you ate before you came to, right, dinner, or you don't have money, mm-hmm, to buy lunch, or you forgot, you know, to eat and it's okay.
Yeah. That's how you kind of shielded that from other people knowing about it outside of your family.
Yeah. Okay. And so it was very confusing because, you know, my eating disorder was my identity. Mm-hmm. It's what I thought about all the time. It's what, you know, I lived my life by. But to the outside world, you know, I was still goofy and, you know, wanting to fit in and party and,
yeah,
you know, have boyfriends. So there was just a lot going on.
I bet. It sounds like it. Do you remember, like, when you bring yourself back into that teenage self, do you remember what you were feeling or thinking around food? Because I think your mom's obviously seeing it from one lens, as is your dad. Do you remember what was happening for you?
Yeah, for me, it was just a, you know, drive to keep going, whether that was restricting, purging, you know, it was just not a thought to change, or it's just how I was. And I didn't really see a problem. You know, it was definitely inconvenient at times, like having to leave a table to go puke. And, you know, there were different things that my family tried to do. Like I would have to sit at the dinner table after dinner with them for a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. But like I said, the eating disorder, you know, just finds a way. So this is disgusting looking back, but, you know, if I knew my parents were listening to hear if the toilet flushed, you know, I worked around that by having a bowl, mm-hmm, that I would keep under my bed to purge, mm-hmm, and then get rid of that later when they went to bed.
Right.
So, yeah, when I think back, there wasn't really any thought to change. It's just what I did.
That's what you did to cope.
Yeah,
and your system was built just for survival, so to say.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I definitely did not have that lens until, you know, later years when I started even working, yeah, with people who have, you know, neurodivergence and eating, yeah, disordered eating.
Yeah, because I cannot wait to get into how you see that crossover, because I think this is such an important conversation to have, in the sense of we're not just talking about disordered eating, but how much that carries into the neurodivergent perspective.
Yeah. And I'm sure anyone listening who knows some of the symptoms of whether it's ADHD or odd ADHD, autism, in some of the, you know, parts of the story I'm telling, to me now it's clear how ADHD, untreated ADHD, was really at play.
Because at that point, when you're describing your teenage years, you have not been diagnosed with ADHD.
No.
Okay.
No, it was not even in the zeitgeist of my family.
Okay. So they're seeing it as Emma has a has an eating disorder. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And a lot of panic around it. Yes, Emma has an eating disorder. And for me at the time, I, you know, part and parcel of the teenage brain, did not see the consequences. I didn't see any sort of threat. The mortality rate thing did not scare me. It was more scary to not have the eating disorder.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it's so important to find those consequences and intentionally look ahead in treatment. And one thing that woke me up a bit was my teeth and the damage I was doing, the amount of cavities I would have when I went to the dentist. So it wasn't until there became some more real consequences that I started to engage in therapy.
Right.
Up until that point, I, you know, the eating disorder was in the driver's seat in therapy.
Yeah.
There was a lot of pretending and, you know, saying I stuck to the meal plan we had created, you know, just to get through the session, to, you know, have my parents kind of off my back.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't until I started to see some of the consequences when I was 17, 18, 19, that, you know, therapy became something interesting and something I could engage with and work, you know, with the eating disorder. And
yeah, because now those things aren't so far in the future, which I think is also an important thing to touch on when we're talking about how at this point you have undiagnosed ADHD. Now, knowing what we know about ADHD, it's really hard for ADHDers to see into the future. It's really hard for us to look at something that's happening, you know, I mean, never mind a week from now, but a year from now, or 10 years or 5 years. So it makes sense that in that moment, that's not what your brain is piecing together until it's actually close enough that those consequences are happening in the here and now.
And then one of the difficulties that I faced, and I see lots of my clients today facing, is that even when there is that awareness and, you know, authenticity with, hey, I don't want to have an eating disorder anymore, and I really see the consequences, they outweigh any pros, help, I want to get better. What becomes really challenging is those patterns that were established for so many years with whether it's restricting and planning every meal, or binge purge patterns.
Yeah.
And so they're so, you know, familiar, easy to fall into.
Yeah.
And when you have untreated ADHD in the mix, it's like climbing up a ski hill. You know, so that's where, for me, real kind of detachment, like changing my identity from having an eating disorder, that didn't come until I started to understand ADHD and see that in myself.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So when did ADHD come on board for you? I mean, obviously it was always there.
Yeah.
But when you're struggling with this, we've been brought up to like 18, 19. like, when did you even get diagnosed with ADHD?
Mm-hmm. So why I didn't see the eating disorder as an issue,
yeah,
is that I still had lots of friends. I got into a great school program for university. I had a job, but there was always this threat of, if I don't recover, I'm not going to move out and go away to school.
Mm.
And so that was very much part of me kind of faking recovery and pretending, you know, that therapy was going great, that it was really helping me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the strategies just got better mm-hmm. to hide it. And so I was, you know, allowed to go off to university and I moved out. And, you know, as we know now, periods of change and mm-hmm. transition are very overwhelming
mm-hmm.
for neurodivergent individuals. People,
absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And moving out and going, relocating for university is a huge change.
Yes. And the pressures of, I was at the University of Waterloo, a very mm-hmm. intense academic yeah. place. And so that was a perfect setup for my eating disorder to come in very high gear
mm-hmm.
because it was the way that I coped. It was the way that I found, you know, a lot of people think, and they're not wrong, that eating disorders are about control. Mm. But I would encourage people to look a bit deeper and look at, you know, what is the function of that control?
Mm.
And so for a lot of people, it's safety.
Okay.
And so when you feel so overwhelmed and out of your environment, you know, there's new teachers who, you know, unlike high school, you know, you're maybe not the best student in the class anymore. You're not getting their approval, all the things that, you know, we know ADHD brains get dopamine from.
Yeah.
Are suddenly gone.
Yeah.
And so the eating disorder is there to kind of remind you that, you know, either you're a piece of shit.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And so you deserve, you know, all the things that it's putting you through. Or, you know, it's this like, if you achieve this and do this, then, you know, then this will be easy or you'll be rewarded.
Yeah.
And it's so sad today when I'm faced with clients who have that at the forefront. You know, these beliefs about their life doesn't begin until they lose weight.
Right. I hear that often from my clients as well, thinking I'll be happier when this happens. Yeah. Things will be different. I'll be able to engage in dating or making new friends or starting the next chapter of my life when mm-hmm. it comes down to a number on a scale.
Yeah.
And that and is it, so hard.
Yeah. And, you know, today it's great that I can see how irrational and how that doesn't fit both for the client sitting across from me
mm-hmm.
and myself.
Yeah.
But when you're so thick in the eating disorder, yeah. it is just what it is. And it's like your whole perception of the world and, of course, yourself changes. And so something I encourage clients who are in the thick of that is to actually start noticing people in bigger bodies who are happy, who are in healthy relationships, who have great careers.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're in the eating disorder, you just don't see that. You only see people who are quote unquote thinner than you, smaller than you, doing better than you.
Right.
Because that's what the eating disorder kind of fuels off yeah. of in most cases.
Yeah. It's that, that's the, what your brain wants you to see is that, that confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
forcing your brain to look at the alternative perspective or reality.
Yeah.
Sounds like can be really helpful for those people.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little mindfulness
yeah.
strategy, which again, if you have untreated ADHD,
mm-hmm.
it's not easy. So, you know, if someone's listening to this right now and is doing all their therapy CBT homework and practicing mindfulness, but they're still, you know, really struggling with their eating disorder, I would encourage you to get more assessments and figure out what else is going on there.
Absolutely. So you have transitioned to university at this point. That's a major change on your nervous system. Mm-hmm. When does an ADHD diagnosis come?
Not in this stint of university, unfortunately.
Okay.
However, I was finding, you know, more appropriate ways of managing ADHD than my eating disorder. Mm-hmm. So I would put in some systems and routines, like I would camp out at the library to be around other nervous systems that were regulated on studying.
Body doubling.
I had a really good friend who would take notes for me. We were in legal studies at Waterloo together. So at this time, it was on our minds that we were going to be writing the LSAT soon and headed to law school. And so it was just a very high pressure, high intense academic environment where grades really mattered. And so when I struggled later into the first semester of university, I had to drop a couple courses. My eating disorder just really spun out of control, and it culminated in a suicide attempt. And so at that time, the lens became Emma has depression.
Okay.
And, you know, it's true. That's what was showing. I was crying all the time. I was just not feeling adjusted at all to Waterloo. But I didn't want to quit. I did want to continue. So having a really good friend kind of kept me, I think, from quitting. And so I'm very grateful that she was someone who, I don't even think at the time I was fully open about my eating disorder, but she was someone who also struggled with mental health. And so we were able to talk about the anxiety and the depression of it all.
So she was a lifeline for you.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is very helpful. Like, I'm even hearing you describe as she did a lot of the executive functioning stuff for you, taking notes, keeping you organized, keeping you on track, doing things that are going to be way harder for your brain with untreated, undiagnosed ADHD.
Yes, exactly.
Big time.
Yeah, we balanced each other out very well. And she became my roommate throughout university. We did a semester in Barbados together. And like you just said, you know, it was her executive function that made that all happen. And then, you know, when you're studying in Barbados, very different than Waterloo. We're on island time, very chill. And so I got to be the support person for her because, you know, she really wanted the plan to work out. And funny enough, we didn't even have our student visas by the time we left the island. That's how disorganized they were. So yes, she was very, very well structured and planned. And that's a very good point. I've never thought about her being my executive function.
Yeah.
But for sure.
You're like that pillar, that person that's doing those things for you.
Yeah.
Well, if you're listening, shout out. Thank you.
Yes, Jenna.
Yay, Jenna.
She's living in Australia now.
We love you, Jenna.
So yes, I didn't drop out. I was put on a great deal of different SSRIs. Because, you know, none of them were working. So,
which for anyone listening is sort of the standard antidepressant medication route, SSRIs. They're trying to target serotonin.
Yes.
Which don't work for everybody. In fact, I think the percentage, they only actually work for about 30 to 35% of people.
Yeah. And my quote unquote depression or symptoms of depression, mm-hmm. you know, were very situational.
Yep.
And it was just, I couldn't cope. You know, my eating disorder was the thing that I coped with, but then suddenly it was not working for mm-hmm. me. I could not function.
Yeah.
I couldn't even keep a glass of orange juice down without having that reflex to purge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so yeah, it's not only the patterns in your mind and emotional patterns that you then have to work to change in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the physical and physiological changes
mm-hmm.
because your system just gets so used to, you know, food and your relationship with food being that way.
Yeah, absolutely. So at that point, after your suicide attempt, there's this diagnosis of depression. How long after that did it take before either you or someone else cued you to maybe it isn't depression?
So on campus,
yeah,
and again, it's such a University of Waterloo thing, but you know, we were not doing drugs or smoking weed on campus, but we were finding ADHD meds.
Mm-hmm. And that's so, a big part of the university college culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so just the pressures, it was like, you know, you needed to stay up extra late or spend X amount of hours studying. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my friends and I would find Adderall, mm-hmm. Concerta at the time too.
Mm.
I think one of our roommates even had a prescription. So, you know, I, in a way, was starting to treat the ADHD,
mm-hmm.
Whereas I just thought it was something that really made me think clearly and
yeah.
be able to sit and do my essay.
Yeah. That was the same for me when I was in university. That's where I tried my first, you know, out of prescription Adderall. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I can actually sit here and focus and do my work and get all of the things done. I need this all of the time. And at that point, it's because that's it was actually treating my ADHD.
Yes.
I didn't just need it as like a study drug.
Yes. But coming from, you know, treating it with substances or food
mm-hmm.
To actually treating it, it feels like you're the limitless guy.
Totally. Yes. Yeah. I've absolutely described it as those first experiences. It's like limitless. You're like, I can do anything. This is amazing. And then you start to realize, oh, this is how a lot of other people's brains work all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just never knew what that was.
Yeah.
What that felt like.
Yeah. And that's so important. And that's why, you know, I really believe in psychoeducation and just sharing the information about whether it's eating disorders as a whole with the client and the client's family
mm-hmm.
or ADHD and that person having the information, whether they rule it in for themselves or have the information and realize, you know, no, I don't connect or relate to this.
Yeah.
Being able to make sense of your past through that lens is so like healing for all the shame that gets carried, you know, when you have something like an eating disorder mm-hmm. as the label or even depression mm-hmm. or
anxiety, like in going, maybe that was a sub-symptom of something deeper that was never treated or acknowledged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't actually a problem. It was a secondary thing. And when you really step back, it was a way to, like you said earlier, survive, cope with the untreated
mm-hmm.
thing. You know, because if you have ADHD or autism, but everyone else around you is holding neurotypical standards.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, with eating, you know, three big meals a day.
Mm-hmm.
you know, that often doesn't really work for neurodivergent people who might need smaller meals throughout the day or, you know, might prefer not sitting at a table with their family.
Or have any sort of sensory sensitivities or issues with like textures, tastes.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good point that you make, because I remember myself and I still eat the same way now as I did as a kid. I'm a grazer. I'm not a sit down, finish a full plate of food, can eat a large meal. I will eat, you know, 8 times a day, 10 times a day in just little amounts. So I remember being a kid and inside silently crying because I had to sit at the table until my meal was finished. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's just not how my system is set up. And it was so overwhelming for me.
And
I never grew out of that.
Right. And is it dysfunctional for you?
No.
No. Right.
It was dysfunctional for a neurotypical standard of how my family thought that kids should eat.
Yep, exactly. And that's what we're seeing so much of, is the pathologizing of, you know, qualities, traits that are just neurodivergent, not neurotypical. And so, you know, I think a common one is foods not touching. And so if you're a parent who kind of just dismisses that real concern of your child and it impacts their ability to actually eat, you know, you're not actually helping with their overall nutrition, if that's the goal of getting them to eat in the first place, if you're serving them the food in a way that they're expressing does not work for them.
Right.
And so I think for families, and, you know, at the time that I was in therapy, there wasn't as much emphasis on family therapy, at least where I was receiving treatment. And so, you know, I would kind of come home with different ways of being with food or expectations of how we should talk about bodies and diet culture. And it was very triggering for my family. I have two brothers, you know, to not be changing with me. So if my brother was still talking about, you know, maybe his current obsession with the gym, for me, who's learning, like, you know, that's, you know, not important. We want to value other things than going to the gym to change our body. It was very hard because my brother was still doing things that I was told are disordered.
Right. So then there's like this gap in understanding and awareness, where you have this one lens of what's helpful or what you should think or how you should change your mentality. But then there's like a gap between what your family knows and how included they are in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's devastating because, you know, I was lucky to have a mother who was really trying her best to learn about eating disorders and to support me. You know, her approach to kind of fix it missed the ADHD. Not her fault. There was also no reason to think that I had ADHD, as is the case with a lot of girls. And
totally, it I mean, it gets missed. The average age of diagnosis in Canada for females is, I think, like 37. Whereas boys, it's age 7. So because there's all of these like misconceptions and misunderstandings in our society, our culture, parents don't know what they don't know, because how could they?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so my younger brother was more the one, you know, who, you know, maybe had a learning issue, and he went to a private school with smaller class sizes for grade 7 and 8 because of those struggles. So he was receiving a lot of the attention in terms of like, okay, there's something here impacting his ability to focus or learn. But I I feel for my younger brother because he was also, you know, compared to myself and my older brother, mm-hmm. who were very, you know, motivated by academics and got great grades. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of reason to think I had ADHD because of the comments from my teachers. Right. You know, I was always a great student.
Yeah, because if you're doing well in school, then everything must be fine.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But then you see those cracks yeah. outside of school and all of the other realms of your life.
Because, you know, it's just so much to manage.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I did great at school, but at what cost, mm-hmm. right? How late was I staying up to perfect my essays or make perfect notes for the test? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of that was just praised or seen as like, mm-hmm. Emma takes great notes and, you know, Emma is such a good student. Mm-hmm. And a lot of girls, it's the socialization of gender to be
totally
polite and good and
quiet and conform. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But inside it's all the hyperactivity.
Yeah.
That's, you know, showing up as critical thinking. For me, a lot of the eating disorder thoughts is mm-hmm. how my mind stayed, you know, distracted.
Yeah. Distracted or quieted a bit.
Yeah.
When you can focus that on the maybe obsessiveness around food.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair to say?
Say it again.
Like to quiet some of that like hyperactivity, you're able school. To channel yes. that into now I'm going to distract myself with focusing on food or how I'm
yes.
purging or how I'm binging.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Yes. Yes. Because in a lot of ways you're kind of self-creating, you know, whole drama, everything that goes into planning a binge, you know, where are you going to binge? How are you going to hide it? What, you know, that's exciting. What are we going to eat?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, of course the relief when you do purge, and it's exhausting. So you don't really have time to maybe worry about some of the things that were on your mind at the end of the school day.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of tire yourself out in this pattern,
mm-hmm.
or if you add working out. And so, yeah, when I think back, it's pretty impressive that I was able to keep up with school. And that's where I see a lot of the strengths of ADHD, just my ability to be resourceful and, you know, get what I needed to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it wasn't always like on time, maybe. Yeah. But maybe I would get a doctor's note to get an extra day to make that essay perfect. So there's lots of ways that your ADHD can like work around the the systems that make it very hard to learn in the way that we're supposed to.
Yeah, we're crafty.
Yeah.
We're very crafty.
Yes.
We can figure things out.
Yes.
Especially in a pinch.
Yes. And it is a strength. And I think also it just leads to so many girls and women living without a diagnosis or the treatment that they might really benefit from because of that masking. And, you know, people see the outer.
Yeah.
Presentation product, but not the inner, you know, exhaustion or turmoil or what, you know, what kind of self-sacrifice was taken to get there.
Yeah. And I think everything that you're describing is a really important lens to have on how to work with clients coming in who are struggling either with ADHD or an eating disorder, to be able to blend this lens to incorporate both, I can imagine is hugely helpful for clients.
Yes. Because so you asked earlier how kind of it went, in my years after 1920. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was a decision that I was pretty scared to make because of you know, the consequences of my parents' disappointment and, you know, what they thought I should do for my career. But I decided to abandon the path for law school.
Okay.
I just did not ever feel like I fit in to the people in the program. I would gravitate towards courses or writing my essays on more social issues. So domestic violence, like women's experience with the law, victims. And I think it was some of my own therapists and seeing them recovered from an eating disorder and being able to help other people that I just felt really compelled to do that too. You know, when you start to get a hold of your eating disorder, it's like you want to share that. And I remember doing something that I don't know how I had the spoons at the time, but I created a blog where, you know, I just decided that I will not get better if this is my biggest secret. And, you know, rather than sharing it to a few close people, I posted it to my Facebook and was just open about eating disorders and how, you know, they, everybody knows somebody who's struggling and we should talk about this. And nobody talked about this when I was dealing with it. And that made it so much harder. And my blog got great response from my community at the time on Facebook.
Wow.
And so I think that just encouraged me to, you know, be able to do this, to identify with this, to not have the shame, which really I think was just a turning point for my identity of you know, not being someone in the thick of an eating disorder anymore, but coming out of it and, you know, wanting to continue. One of the biggest myths about eating disorders is that they don't go away, that you will always have an eating disorder. And I can't speak for all cases. I do think that sometimes the eating disorder is perhaps in the background of someone's life and might, you know, be prone to coming up kind of like a relapse in a time where they are needing that safety, that that comfort, that way of coping. But I do think through therapy and good support systems, you can find other ways of coping through really difficult times. You don't have to live in fear that you're always going to have an eating disorder. And I think that's a big deterrent for people taking treatment seriously. Because, you know, what's the point?
I think that's such a good myth to bust, because that's actually one that I have heard from clients who have gone through any sort of inpatient, outpatient program. They have they've
been told by doctors,
I will always have an eating disorder. And then what do you do with that from there? So I think that's good that you're busting that myth by going, that's not true.
Well, yeah.
And there are absolutely people that can recover from that and find harmony and peace and love for their body and food. And
I'm really hopeful to see eating disorder treatment as a whole move more and more away from just a medical approach. Of course, the medical system is very important and plays a role in some eating disorders. So with my bulimia, you know, it was important to get EKGs. And blood work. You know, my potassium was very low. You know, when you're in recovery, we're not expecting abstinence from the symptoms. Is that the right word? And it's not like cocaine or alcohol that you can just not ever face again. Alcohol is a bit tougher in our society.
But you have to eat.
Exactly.
Like you can't stay away from it.
Yeah. And what a depressing message to tell people.
Yeah.
That this thing that is such an important part of cultures has different meanings, you know, and celebrations are around food, mm-hmm. That you're always going to have a disordered relationship, mm-hmm. that this is always going to control you and make these things stressful and not what they're meant to be. Mm-hmm. Celebrations, you know, enjoyment, events with friends and family. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, let's really debunk that myth because, you know, the medical model, of course. So going back to that point, that plays a role. So, you know, with anorexia, of course, sometimes you do need to be hospitalized to get your weight to a healthy level again. Mm-hmm. But you don't stay there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very problematic when we continue to view someone's recovery through that lens mm-hmm. of threat and fear. You know, we want to really support that person to find what they need to live a life that's more authentic and going to work for them with their relationship with food, body, mm-hmm. emotions. Another myth is that eating disorders are just about food mm-hmm. and body. Mm-hmm. Again, of course, that's how they present or what yep. people see. But, you know, it's really often about attachment to early caregivers and the attunement mm. of those emotional needs. Mm-hmm. And so if you didn't receive that from caregivers, you know, those emotions mm-hmm. Have really nowhere to go. And so food is often something that people find in their house mm-hmm. to give them that comfort.
Right.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And I think too, even when we're talking about untreated ADHD, a lot of those behaviors can also be how you're regulating your nervous system.
Yes.
Dopamine seeking, or either up or down regulating your nervous system, or yes. have to do with impulse control.
Absolutely. So, and it's such a feedback loop because as we know, your prefrontal cortex, you know, it needs good self-care. It needs mm-hmm. sleep. It mm-hmm. needs food. It needs, you know, to be able to function based on what we fuel it with.
Yeah.
And so ADHD prefrontal cortexes are already lacking fuel. Mm-hmm. Let's say just the dopamine, norepinephrine that we know. Mm-hmm. And then you combine that with forgetting to eat mm-hmm. or not drinking water all day.
Yeah.
And so
that impacted sense of interoception. So that is what Emma's referencing. It's one of the hidden senses. So how we sense our own cues. So that could be hunger cues, pain cues, whether thirst. We need to go to the bathroom, yeah. thirst, all of those things. So when that is already impaired, mm-hmm. that's going to impact how we show up in terms of when we're eating, how we're eating.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So even when you have that meal plan from your well-intentioned therapist, it's a whole other thing to remember, you know, to put the plan in action mm-hmm. or to, you know, have the impulse control to actually inhibit the eating disorder thought of, yep. oh, I can just skip lunch. Mm-hmm. Or the ADHD thought of, this is more important.
Yeah.
The task I'm focused on.
Yeah. I can't interrupt what I'm already doing. And just all of the executive function that goes into food itself. Because what you just described, there's the, okay, now I have to plan my meals, which means I have to go to the grocery store, which means I need to remember to get everything on the list. And then I have to plan my time to be able to do that. And then how much time it takes to cook meals and whether I forget those meals if I go somewhere. Like, there's so much that goes into eating.
Yes, exactly. Just for a regular person mm-hmm. too. But yeah, somebody with the combination of some disordered eating or an eating disorder and the executive function issues with ADHD,
mm-hmm.
it's not surprising. I think there's a very logical explanation why we don't see people getting better
mm-hmm.
from their eating disorder, or yeah. it becomes a very chronic pattern and relapsing back.
Because we're missing something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so for me, it wasn't until I was almost 25. And, you know, at this point I had gotten into my master's for psychotherapy in Toronto. So again, I was doing another big change.
Mm-hmm.
One that I was really excited for. And, you know, I was really pumped to live in downtown Toronto, coming from the suburbs and then going to Waterloo.
Mm.
You know, it was all positive. I was joining a program that I knew would get me into doing what I wanted to do, which was to be a psychotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember when I moved to Toronto, I was expecting the intensity of school that I had just experienced at Waterloo.
Mm-hmm.
But in your master's, you know, you have a lot less courses. First semester, you're not doing your practicum or anything.
Mm.
And so I got a job going door to door fundraising for CAMH.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in this time that I started, you know, really just believing that I had ADHD. I think being, maybe having more confidence to read books on psychotherapy and mental health. I just really, you know, saw that this is what I have. And I went to countless doctors in Toronto mm-hmm. to try to get a diagnosis.
Yeah.
Did not work.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I think I referenced that in every podcast episode that I've done, the experience of trying to get diagnosed late in life.
Yeah.
And how hard that can be for like too many people.
And I distinctly remember a doctor telling me that I'm just trying to get drugs
mm-hmm.
for school.
Right.
When she learned I was a student.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not wrong
mm-hmm.
because, you know, in the end, there is a happy ending. It was actually my family doctor. I was self-medicating at this time with alcohol. I had found cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was not doing well. I was underweight. And she, thankfully, believed me when I said I have ADHD. I think it took, which again is so devastating because it's the same story with eating disorders. Mm-hmm. If you're not thin,
mm-hmm.
that's another myth about eating disorders, right? You do not have to be thin. It's like 7% or something so low of people with an eating disorder mm-hmm. are actually underweight.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I think for therapists too, like, you know, really don't make assumptions, really try to
mm-hmm.
create a safe space so that your client can talk about their disordered eating.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Because I think too, you bringing up that point, that's something that we didn't really specify at the beginning of this episode, but even when we're talking about eating disorders, there are so many varieties. Yeah. Like we could be talking about anorexia, we could be talking about bulimia, we could be talking about binge eating, mm. we're talking about ARFID.
Yeah.
Like there's, and that's just to name
yeah.
some.
Yeah. Yeah. There's, you know, again, I don't think most people probably fall neatly into one bucket.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause the eating disorder just finds other ways of doing what it does. And
mm-hmm.
I've heard from some people, you know, oh, I would purge, but I'm scared of throwing up. So that's great, you know, having some protective factors there, but then it just doubles down on exercise or...
Right. Or laxatives or...
Yeah.
Something else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So for me, you know, I had done years of therapy. I never went into an inpatient hospital program, but after my suicide attempt, I did an outpatient program at St. Joe's in Hamilton. And for me, that really helped because part of it was group-based. And so just, again, the disorder, which thrives in secrecy and shame and isolation, you know, it was harder to believe all the things that it tells you when you see other people struggling. And I think that's a strength of ADHD is you can really, you know, easily empathize. Like I have a lot of empathy for other people's stories. You know, and it's very, I'm very motivated to help somebody else. And so if I have those thoughts about someone else, then, you know, the more compassionate I am there, it just increases those pathways to be self-compassionate.
So for you, you feel like a really important part of treatment is the group aspect of things, of being able to relate to other people.
And, you know, that is scary as hell when you're in the thick of the eating disorder.
I can imagine.
Or, you know, you're in the heightened ADHD symptoms of rejection sensitivity. You know, that need for approval is so high. You know, or with people who are autistic, you know, it might be very overwhelming to be in a group environment, period. And so the thought of working on your eating disorder in that environment is often, you know, and I don't blame them. A lot of my clients just are not ready. And and so it's definitely something that is kind of part of later stages of recovery. I think it can be probably pretty traumatic for other group members too, if somebody is really in the thick of, you know, the eating disorder and not having the motivation to get better. Yeah, that just made me think of like the old Tumblr. Thankfully, I think they're banned now, but I heard they were popping up again on Instagram and TikTok, but these like pro anorexia accounts where my leading kind of disorder was never anorexia. I'm too ADHD for that. But, and what I mean by that is, you know, some of the qualities of autism, like the need for structure, preferences with routine and systems, planning. That can really make somebody thrive with anorexia. Because you're very disciplined to those routines and patterns. And if you set them up so you're eating nothing at all or very small,
you're able to follow that to a T because that's the kind of internal rule you've set for yourself.
So that rule governed behavior, because eating disorders, you know, they have lots of rules. Your eating disorder, they have lots of rules for you and how you should live, how other people should be too. And then like you were saying earlier, interoception. Can't say that word. Interoception, you know, that is so big with ARFID. So ARFID is avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And, you know, if you already have a lack of hunger signals, so you don't have that feeling of hunger in the morning or throughout the day, there's not really a motivation to eat. So it's very easy to avoid. But then you combine the sensory differences. And for a lot of people, you know, the food groups or the types of food they eat become very narrow because of the stress that comes with, you know, certain textures.
Yeah. Or strong tastes.
Yep. Yeah. Smells even.
Yep.
And so ARFID is, you know, something that we're seeing a lot more in the autistic population, but anorexia too. You know, it's, we were reading earlier that it's anywhere from 20 to 37%
yeah.
of people with anorexia
meet the criteria for autism. Yeah.
I knew it was high, but yeah, 37.
And I would say that those percentages are still probably underrepresented based on who they're studying and the limitations of even research thus far. But that's a fantastic point to make.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point because, you know, I think autism, we're seeing the same thing with ADHD, that it's not just a little boys or boys condition. And so there is, you know, just as many autistic girls out there as autistic boys.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't a awareness that that is autism because it shows up a bit differently.
Absolutely.
For example, like girls can have a variety of special interests.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the pressures of society on women, they're often more like socially acceptable ones. So they're things that you aren't like isolated doing, you know, on your lunch breaks alone, but you find other girls who like to horseback ride and that becomes very easy to, you know, talk about or parallel play, do kind of socially, even if you're not like, you know, doing it for the social.
But there's a lot more to learn and understand.
Yeah.
And I think that you, I mean, I think you've done a really good job throughout this podcast of debunking a lot of myths and misconceptions and really tying in how neurodivergency can correlate to eating disorders. What are, for anyone listening that wants to know more, what are some resources that you would recommend?
Mm-hmm.
Anything that you think would be a good go-to resource?
Yeah, so in Canada, a completely free agency is NEDIC. So it's the NEDIC, National Education Information Center, for Eating Disorders. And so on there, they have a provider directory, so you can find therapists, different types of treatment providers who NEDIC has vetted, has specialized training and, you know, experience working with eating disorders. If you are looking for therapy, I would recommend finding someone who also has on their profile that they work with neurodivergence. You know, you don't want to ignore that.
Okay.
You're going to be in therapy forever.
Yeah.
Trying to change these patterns. If you have something like autism, ADHD or ADHD and you don't know it, it's so just going to work.
Ruling that in or out in early stages is going to help.
Yeah.
How treatment's going to go moving forward.
Yeah, and I think being upfront to your therapist, if you've, you know, related to some things on TikTok or in this conversation, just be honest with your therapist that, like, you know, I'm struggling with symptoms of what's an eating disorder, but I want to make sure I don't have, you know, something else.
Like, yeah. So let's make sure we're addressing that before we move forward, or at least, like, in conjunction.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Because a neurodivergent affirming therapist would very easily see
some of those connections.
Yes.
Yeah.
So for example, with ADHD, a lot of the disordered eating that's pathologized and focused on is really an attempt to seek dopamine. And so, you know, binge eating, you know, maybe not being able to stop, like my dad, once you open a bag of chips, it's just like a sensory, you know, dopamine experience. Yep. It's like really soothing. Or maybe when you're watching something on TV, it's something to keep your hands busy. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not actually about the food or your body in that moment. It's really about something completely separate. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we're not going to get very far if we just focus on body image and meal plans and how to eat differently alone. Mm-hmm. Because the actual problem is your nervous system regulation. Yeah. You know, people with ADHD and autism, we just need different outputs. We take so much in.
Yeah.
And so if you can imagine like having a day of classes and then you go to work and then you have to come home, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, I just want to eat in my bed and watch TV. Mm-hmm. And that's what your nervous system might actually need after mm-hmm. you know, receive all that input from
the world. You've been overstimulated and or understimulated for the day.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So those are two good or suggestions for resources. And so my last question would be, what advice would you give yourself, like your younger self, if she were listening to this podcast today in your own journey of an eating disorder and untreated ADHD for so long? Like, what would you say to her?
I would want her to have the belief that it will get better. Mm. You will not always have this obsession mm-hmm. with food, and there will be a day very soon where you don't purge. I remember in recovery, it was always like trying to get through a day. Mm-hmm. And then it became like, okay, 2 days. But it was so hard, and it felt like an impossible task to go a week without binging and purging. Mm-hmm. But that's why I am such an advocate for women, especially looking into how their brain works, getting an assessment for ADHD, autism, mm-hmm. because, you know, I really can't express how easy it got to stop mm-hmm. once I treated the ADHD. Yeah. I just no longer needed that obsessive thinking. The binging and purging completely stopped. Mm-hmm. It's something I am so gratified to see, you know, in my clients when they get their diagnosis mm-hmm. and if they start medication, especially for those who are really in the binge eating cycle. To be honest, the way that I got my diagnosis was also by reading the DSM and reading about binge eating disorder, doing research and learning that Vyvanse mm-hmm. is prescribed for binge eating disorder. Yeah.
First line use is ADHD, second line is binge eating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for me, it's like, I just wanted to try that. It was so hard for me to get through, you know, a day, 2 days without a binge.
Yeah.
And so I think that was part of my conversation with my doctor, is just coming to her with the facts of, you know, and so, yeah, I wish my younger self was able to be more open sooner mm-hmm. to maybe have these types of conversations to reflect on. But that's actually what I was going to say earlier. If you're not ready for a group, I think finding books, you know, YouTube videos where therapists are talking about their experience with eating disorders mm-hmm. or the experience of their clients, to really like see that there's, you know, others who are dealing with this. You're not alone. You will get better.
I think that's such a good message for you to put out in the world. And I think that there are potentially going to be people listening who can really use hearing that sentiment mm-hmm. that you're sharing, not only your story, but helping people get to the space that you've gotten to.
Yeah.
And maybe making it easier for them to feel like they can talk to their therapist about it if they have one, or reach out to other supports in some way.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, believe in the neuroplasticity. And if it's not changing on your own, then, you know, there's probably a reason why. You know, therapy and medication, it really is the magic combo for a lot of things. We can't, you know, just do one without the other often when we're in the thick of a disorder. Doesn't mean you have to stay on medication forever, but it really helps change those patterns, that neuroplasticity, where, like we said, if we have, you know, deficits in our executive function, so memory, even being able to recall what we focused on in therapy, you know, what we were going to be mindful of this week, goes out the window. And so, yes, I really, you know, would just want my younger self to know it gets easier, that it's not always, you know, pushing a boulder up a ski hill. And yeah, that's just why I really assess for that, and why my practice did really shift to be more, you know, neurodivergent focused, as opposed to, you know, eating disorders being the primary focus.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. And for anyone listening that has similar struggles, I hope that, you know, you are able to reach out and get the types of support that you need. And all of Emma's information will also be linked in this episode. So if you are in the GTA or in Ontario and you're looking for neurodivergent affirming supports, you can reach out to her clinic. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you, Kaylee.
Thanks for tuning in to ADHD Brief. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing or sharing it with someone who might relate. For more information on resources from today's episode, check out the show notes on your listening platform or feel free to contact us directly. The views and opinions shared by my guests are their own and may not always reflect mine. At ADHD Brief, we value open conversations and differing perspectives. I encourage listeners to approach each episode with kindness and curiosity. Even when something comes from a place of stigma or misunderstanding, offering grace and compassion creates more room for growth than criticism ever could. Thanks for tuning in.